and Champaign. The staff at the Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and at the controls this morning is Jason Croft. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the war on cancer. Back in 1971, then-President Richard Nixon declared the war against cancer, and Congress passed the National Cancer Act. Since that time, an enormous amount of money has gone into the study of cancer, its causes, and its treatment. However, our guest for this part of Focus 580 argues that we are losing the war on cancer and have been for some time. Our guest is Samuel Epstein. He is Professor Emeritus of Environmental and Occupational Medicine at the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago and Chairman of the Cancer Prevention Coalition. He has been writing about and talking about the importance of prevention of cancer for quite a long time. He says that the incidence of cancers has escalated to epidemic proportions and overall mortality rates have remained unchanged for decades. And he says the reason that we are losing the war against cancer is that we're making two very basic and important mistakes. One is that we're putting almost all of our resources into treating people who have cancer once it already has struck, and related to that is the fact that we have ignored the issue of prevention. He believes that there is strong evidence to show that an awful lot of cancer we have in this country is due to avoidable exposures to carcinogens in the environment, and that it doesn't really have quite as much to do with lifestyle, things like fat in the diet or smoking, as often we hear. He is perhaps best known for his book, The Politics of Cancer, that was published back in 1978 and then revised as and republished as The Politics of Cancer Revisited, that in 1998. And he has a new book out now brings together some of the work that he has done over the years. It's titled Cancergate, How to Win the Losing Cancer War. It's published by Baywood Publishing. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are just brief, so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But questions, comments certainly are welcome. Dr. Epstein, hello.
Good morning, Mr. Inge.
Thank you very much for talking with us. Can you give us some numbers? And I know that you you say that there are a lot of numbers out there, numbers about how many people get cancer and how well we are doing in the battle against cancer.
Sure.
And I think that you feel that maybe not all of those numbers are good, and it might depend on who it is that's offering them.
Well, fine. First of all, can I congratulate you on your nice summary of the situation. There's just two qualifications I'd like to make.
Yes.
I do believe you gave the impression that I don't believe that smoking is an important cause of cancer. I stress constantly throughout the book that smoking is the single most important cause of cancer worldwide. That's the first point. The second point is you used the word believes on a couple of occasions, and don't think I'm being nitpicking. It's not a question of belief. The data on which the book is based, first of all, has been endorsed by well over 100 leading national and international scientists, and it's fully documented based on publications and peer-reviewed journals. So with those minor qualifications, for which I hope you'll forgive me, let me try to move on.
Yes.
Now, the data on cancer incidence and mortality, which I quote, are not my own. They come from the National Cancer Institute in what's called a SEER program, which is supposedly an annual review of incidence and mortality together with a great deal of ancillary information. So the figures on which my positions have been based for decades have not been information that I've conjured up myself, but comes from official NCI, supposedly annual reports, but actually sometimes they come out every 2 or 3 years. Now, first of all, let's get into the actual figures, which you touched upon. Nearly 1 in 2 men and more than 1 in 3 women are now getting cancer. And that is a very substantial increase in the incidence as from the 1970s. And for certain cancers, which when you look at certain cancers, you'll find the rates of increase are alarming. Now, these rates are based on what's called an age-standardized basis. For instance, as people grow older over the last 30 or 40 years or so, people are living longer, and therefore you would expect more cancer. So for this reason, the National Cancer Institute data are now age-standardized. In other words, you're looking at people at the age of 60 to 70 now, and the people at the age of 60 to 70, 30, 40 years ago. So aging of the population has nothing at all to do with what are called age-standardized cancer incidence rates. Now, let's look at mortality. What's happened over the last few decades? You find the changes in mortality, in spite of the overwhelming expenditures, and we'll come to the expenditures later on, have really changed relatively little. But on the other hand, the incidence of a very wide range of cancers has shot up. Now, the apparent anomaly is as follows. Lung cancer has always been the single most important cause of cancer, and that's been due to smoking. And as the Surgeon General's report came out in 1964, since then, we've seen a steady decrease in the incidence of lung cancer in men due to the reduction in smoking. So what has happened is you're having a decrease in the incidence of lung cancer, to a lesser extent in women, of course, women regrettably, but making up for that, major increases in the incidence of a wide range of non-smoking cancers. And it's this wide range of non-smoking cancers I and others have expressed very great concern, because we do have information on their avoidable causes, and we can discuss avoidable causes later on. But to fix the mind wonderfully, let's go through some of these increases. From 1975 to the latest data, which is about 2 years ago, the overall incidence in childhood cancers have gone up by about 30%. And for some childhood cancers, they've gone up nearly 70%. For acute leukemias, nearly 70% from 1975 onwards. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, another cancer, has gone up about 74% in men and nearly about 80%. Breast cancer, postmenopausal breast cancer, 36%. Thyroid cancers, 88%. Melanomas, 130%. Kidneys, 75%. And many of these cancers bear no relation whatsoever to smoking. And another cancer, which I neglected to mention, was acute leukemia, which is about 56%. So here we have seen a massive increase in the incidence of a non-smoking cancers. The American public have not been informed about this major increase. They have not been informed about a wide range of avoidable causes of cancer. And they have not been informed about the fact that billions of dollars have been spent in the cancer war with minimal recognition of the need to make available to the public current information on avoidable causes of cancer, which is the National Cancer Institute has not made available. And so this is the basic issue. Now, before proceeding on this, I should point out to your listeners that there are two institutions in this country that have fundamental responsibility in this whole area of cancer. One is the National Cancer Institute, which is a federal institute. It used to be part of the National Institutes of Health, of which there are some 25, dealing with problems ranging from diabetes to lung disease, etc. But when President Nixon, as you pointed out, declared the war on cancer, he was persuaded to make the National Cancer Institute autonomous and reporting directly to the president, which really meant that the National Cancer Institute became divorced from the general public health community. So here is one element of the leadership, the National Cancer Institute. The second is the American Cancer Society, which is the world's largest leading charity or non-for-profit organization. Now, both of these organizations are overwhelmingly fixated on damage control. By damage control, I mean screening, diagnosis, treatment, and treatment-related research, with minimal interest or indifference, and in the case of the American Cancer Society, extending to actual hostility to prevention. Now, I use the words advisedly. I'm not using adjectives willy-nilly. There's solid documentation for this, which has been published in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and which is laid out in even more greater detail in the book Cancergate, How to Win the Losing Cancer War, and fully with full documentation and large-scale endorsement. Now, let's look into this in a further detail. Why is it that we're seeing this massive increase? And I've given one reason already. That is because of the cancer establishment, which is the National Cancer Institute, American Cancer Society, are indifferent or hostile to prevention. But let's look at some figures on this. From 1970 or so, when the budget of the National Cancer Institute was about $170 million, the budget is now $5 billion per annum, which is a 30-fold increase. Now, when you plot the increase of the budget of the National Cancer Institute against cancer incidence, you find that the more money we spend, the more cancer we get, which seems a little strange. But there is almost a parallelism between the amount of money the National Cancer Institute spends on cancer every year and the actual massive increase in the incidence. And the answer to this is that these overwhelming resources of the National Cancer Institute go to treatment. Of course, it's terribly important. As a physician, I take second place to no one on the critical need to give the best treatment possible to cancer patients. But the point that it should be made is the more cancer that there is prevented, the less cancer there is to treat. And with the American Cancer Society, their budget is now nearly $1 billion a year, from about less than 100 million in the 70s. So there is this paradox, this apparent paradox, and we need to understand these facts before we proceed further. Now, let's take one element at a time. If you look at the promises of the American Cancer Society and National Cancer Institute from the time that President Nixon declared the war on cancer, you find there have been a series of false promises claiming that cancer mortality, for instance, in 1984, National Cancer Institute claimed that cancer mortality would be halved by 2000. In 1996, more recently, National Cancer Institute claims to have turned the tide against cancer. In 1998, National Cancer Institute and American Cancer Society claimed a reversal of almost 20-year trend of increasing cancer cases and deaths. These numbers are the proof we're on the right track. No such thing at all, so on and so forth. But let me take you to an opposing viewpoint from leading oncologists in the country. An Associated Press report 2 years ago quoted some leading oncologists questioning whether cancer will ever be reliably and predictably cured, and they admitted that the new magic bullet drugs, over which we're spending the overwhelming budget of the National Cancer Institute, American Cancer Society, they are as powerless as old-line chemotherapy 30 years ago. And a Nobel laureate, Leland Hartwell, who's a distinguished president of the Fred Hutchinson Comprehensive Cancer Center, warned that nearly all the resources which are now spent on cancer research are spent on, I quote, promoting ineffective drugs for terminal disease. In other words, if you have somebody with lung cancer, and this is, unfortunately, in nearly all instances, a death sentence, to treat this patient with a very expensive drug, which will be highly toxic and will extend his or her life for possibly 1 to 2 to 3 months, this is where most of our resources are being spent. Now, there is no argument about the fact there have been significant advances for some chemotherapy, for instance, for tamoxifen in breast cancer, and another drug, Herceptin, in breast cancer, and a drug called Rituxan for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But the so-called targeted therapies, such as for which we're spending most of our money now, which are targeted at specific receptor sites in cells, when they added to standard chemotherapy, they increase cancer survival, lung cancer survival rates, by about 1 to 2 months. So what we're seeing is hype and gross exaggeration of the targeted therapies with unparalleled frank propaganda and exaggeration of minimal benefits with minimal reference to the very high toxicity, minimal reference to the inflationary costs, And this is what the situation as far as cancer drugs are concerned. Now, you may say, well, now look, what's all this about? What's going on? How is it that these major institutions, which have life and death in their power, why is it that they have abysmally failed in their task of not, well, one can't blame them necessarily for their task of curing cancer, because I think this is a very, very difficult problem. But what you can unequivocally blame them for is the massive escalation in the incidence of cancer rates, because we know what the avoidable causes of many of these cancers are. But let me first of all touch on some of the underlying reasons for the positions of the National Cancer Institute and American Cancer Society. And there is overwhelming conflicts of interest. And let's run through some of these briefly. For instance, the policy of the National Cancer Institute is under the control of a president's cancer panel. And the very first president's cancer panel, the chairman of the president's cancer panel from the 1970s to the 80s, was a man called Benno Schmidt. That's for the National Cancer Institute President's Cancer Panel. He was a senior drug company executive, and clearly his interests were in cancer drugs and not in the slightest interested at all in prevention. And in fact, when you look at the policies and what happened in the 70s, you find that the budget spent on prevention was about somewhere in the region of 3 to 4%, if that. In the 1980s, the next president of the cancer panel was Armand Hammer, who was chairman of Occidental Petroleum, one of the nation's largest manufacturer of carcinogenic petrochemicals. And when you look at the directors of the National Cancer Institute, you find that the first director resigned and then became, in 1976, a man called Frank Rauscher, and then became director of the Thermal Insulation Manufacturers Association, which promotes the unregulated use of carcinogenic fiberglass. You have Samuel Broder, who resigned in 1995 to join a very successful drug company. And in a Washington Post interview, he admitted, "The National Cancer," and I quote, "The National Cancer Institute has become what amounts to a governmental pharmaceutical company." Richard Klausner, former NCI director, is now under congressional investigation for not only accepting financials from rewards, Electra awards, from his own comprehensive cancer centers, and if he was a director, he would go and visit one and collect money for it, but also he has been subject to charges under California's Corporate Criminal Liability Act for promoting a very dangerous dietary supplement used for prostate health, which was laced with a dangerous prescription drug, diethylstilbestrol, and so on and so forth. What we have seen also is consistent violation of the charges of the National Cancer Act to, quote, to disseminate cancer information to the public. And this, there has been an overwhelming neglect. When it comes to the American Cancer Society, their conflicts of interest are literally overwhelming. It's difficult to know where to begin, so I'll go through some of their conflicts of interest and then get on to their track record on prevention. From 1998, as you know, I stressed right at the beginning that smoking is the single most important cause of cancer, of lung cancer in particular, and lung cancer rates in men are dropping because of giving up smoking. Now, the American Cancer Society has always taken the position, likewise the National Cancer Institute, if you get cancer, it's your own fault. You smoke too much, or you drink too much, or you spend too much time in the sun, or you're overweight. Let's look at the smoking. From 1998 to 2000, the public relations for the American Cancer Society was handled by Shandwick International. Hold your breath. The major clients of Shandwick International were R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Holdings. This was all secret. When we discovered this, and I put out a press release on this, they switched, American Cancer Society promptly switched. They sacked Shandwick, and they promptly contracted to Edelman Public Relations Worldwide. Now, Edelman Public Relations, the major clients are Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company, and also the Altria Group, which is the parent company of Philip Morris, and also the parent company of a wide range of fast food and soft drink beverage companies, which we are now targeting for anti-obesity litigation. So on the one hand, they talk about tobacco and obesity as being the leading cause of cancer and tobacco. They're absolutely right. We've always maintained that. But behind the scenes, the strong linkages between American Cancer Society and the tobacco industry, and also the fast food and soft drink industry. When you look at the funding of the American Cancer Society, they have a series. The American Cancer Society collects money from the public who mistakenly believe that it's going to help the war against cancer. But let's tell you where a lot of the industry funding, where a lot of the funding of American Cancer Society comes from. They get annual donations in excess of $100,000 each from a wide range of, quote, X-caliber donors. These include petrochemical companies, companies that manufacture carcinogenic chemicals ranging from DuPont, Pennzoil, etc. Industrial waste companies, BFI waste systems, and you know when you live near hazardous waste sites, your risks of cancer are increased. Fast food companies, biotech companies, cosmetic companies, cosmetics and toiletries are literally witches' brews of undisclosed carcinogenic ingredients and contaminants, which were fully documented. In addition to that, very, very large amounts of money come from what we call Big Pharma. Big Pharma is the generic name for the pharmaceutical industry that produces cancer drugs at enormous profits, like AstraZeneca, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Glaxo, etc. Now, the interesting thing is that the majority of this money goes for drugs for treatment of terminal disease, for which there is millions of patients are treated with these, and as I say, the extension of life is generally pretty minimal. When it comes to drugs for treatment of childhood cancer, virtually not a penny is being spent, largely because the market for childhood, the relatively small numbers of children get cancers, but virtually not a penny is spent on this. But let's go on to the American Cancer Society track record and prevention. And you find the American Cancer Society, over and above these conflicts of interest, have been in bed with a wide range of industries. And I have a long track record of testifying before congressional hearings and also drafting legislation. So this is an area which I'm thoroughly familiar with. And American Cancer Society, for instance, in 71, refused to testify at congressional hearings. They used on banning the very dangerous estrogenic drugs like diethylstilbestrol to fatten cattle in feedlots. They created, in 1984, they created October Breast Cancer Awareness Month to assure women that early mammography results in cures nearly 100% of time. But they had already, in a book prior to that, stated that for 95% of cases, women discover their tumors themselves. But when they were questioned about this statement that mammography results in cure nearly 100% of time, they answered as follows, and I quote the language: "Mammography today is a lucrative and highly competitive business. Mammography today is a lucrative and highly competitive business. And also, in the awareness month, there's no mention made of avoidable causes of breast cancer." And in 1992, the American Cancer Society, behind the scenes, joined hands with the Chlorine Institute and supported them in defending the continued use of chlorinated pesticides of the aldrin, dieldrin, chlordane, heptachlor, which are unequivocally carcinogenic, which contaminate our air, our water, our food, and the workplace, and are environmentally persistent. And they did this behind the scenes. In 1993, the Chronicle of Philanthropy, looking at that data, some of which I've cited already, concluded the American Cancer Society is more interested in accumulating wealth than in saving lives.
If you'll forgive me, Dr. Epstein, for jumping in here, we've already used almost half our time, and I think I probably should at least introduce you again. And also, we have a couple of callers I think you'd like to get in. Let me say that our guest for the program is Dr. Samuel Epstein. He is Professor Emeritus of Environmental and Occupational Medicine at the School of Public Health at University of Illinois Chicago, and is also Chairman of the Cancer Prevention Coalition. And as you can tell, the issue of prevention is something that he is quite passionate about, and in fact has been writing about this talking about it for a long time, making the argument that the reason that we have not been more successful in dealing with cancer in this country is that we have put almost none of our resources into prevention, but almost all into trying to treat cancer once people have already been diagnosed with cancer.
At risk of interrupting you,
yes,
may I just say an additional point?
Yes.
And furthermore, quite apart from not researching these areas, they have failed, what is even more important, they have failed to inform the public of a substantial body of published scientific information unavoidable causes of this cancer. Therefore, in other words, they have denied the public their democratic right to know of ways and means in which these cancers could be prevented and avoided.
Mm-hmm. And we have talked about some of the things that get the attention. And I certainly at the beginning was happy to have your correction, because I certainly would not want to give anyone the impression that smoking was not a problem, or that you thought smoking was not a problem.
When
we are told about things that we as individuals can do to lessen our cancer risk, it seems that most of the attention does go to don't smoke or stop if you're a smoker. And also, there has been some emphasis on fat in the diet, particularly when it comes to colorectal cancer, and perhaps also some people think that it may have something to do with breast cancer. But as you say, that you say that there is data to show that there are other causes and that they are things that are indeed avoidable if people knew about them. And is it basically, here we're talking about industrial chemicals, essentially, things that are either in products that we use or as a result of the manufacturing process end up getting into the environment?
All the above. Mm. And it's not a question, excuse me, you think, please don't think I'm being argumentative. It's not what I'm actually saying. It's what I'm publishing in peer-reviewed journals, the leading peer-reviewed journals, which are very tough to get into. And these positions have been endorsed by well over 100 leading national and international experts on cancer prevention. And at risk of appearing self-directed, I should point out that I have just returned from Europe, where I received the Albert Schweitzer Annual Gold Medal for international contributions to cancer prevention. So I think we're really talking about solid facts, and I'd be very happy to offer you some examples of these. And I can do this for childhood cancers or for breast cancer. Would you like me to offer some examples on childhood cancer?
Sure. Why don't you do that? Yeah.
Fine. Your question is, what information is being denied to the public on avoidable causes of cancer?
Mm-hmm.
And in my book, The Cancer Gate, How to Win the Losing War on Cancer, this is documented in overwhelming detail. But let us just look at childhood cancers, of which, as I mentioned earlier on, the incidence rates have shot up dramatically in the last few decades. Now, you can't say this is due to smoking. You can't say this is due to obesity. You can't say it's due to any of these classic explanations of lifestyle. But let's look at, first of all, environmental. There's three major categories of avoidable causes. One are environmental, two are domestic, and three are medical. The environmental ones, we have strong evidence that if people, children, and families that live near petrochemical industries or large-scale combustion processes or municipal incinerators and nuclear power plants, etc., that there are elevated levels of childhood cancers. Now, we have data on this not only in the United States. We have data on this in other countries, solid data in Europe, solid data in North France, etc. The next category of environmental is exposure to carcinogenic pesticides from agricultural and urban spraying and, hold your breath, uses in schools, including wood playground sets, treated with a highly potent carcinogen called chromated copper arsenate. A third, a so-called environmental or occupational, is if a mother or father works in a plant where he or she is exposed to carcinogens during pregnancy or even before or after pregnancy, there are major elevations in childhood cancer rates. Let's turn to the medical, the ways and means in which the medical profession can help give increased risks of childhood cancer. That sounds an inflammatory statement to make, but let me justify it. First of all, maternal radiation during late pregnancy used to be standard practice in both England and in the United States, just to make sure that the head of the fetus was firmly fixed in the pelvis. And we gradually developed information by the 50s or so that these children, the infant when they were born, and they grew up into childhood, that there was major excesses of childhood cancers, particularly leukemia, from the radiation. Then there's a series of prescription drugs during pregnancy, notably diethylstilbestrol and dilantin. And these, when a mother was given those, are very significant increases in childhood cancer. Pediatric prescription drugs, Lindane shampoos for lice, Ritalin for attention deficit disorders. ionizing radiation for treatment of scalp ringworms or even enlarged tonsils, which enlarged tonsils is no longer being done. Then the next is high-dose diagnostic radiation, particularly CAT scans. For instance, if a child falls down and hits his head, very often he's subjected to a high dose of radiography from a CAT scan, and the radiation dose from that is about 15 times higher than is necessary to get good imaging, and with the result, we're seeing increase in childhood leukemias from this. Now, what about the home? What can happen in the home that will increase risks of childhood cancer? Well, there's a wide range. Drinking and cooking water contaminated with carcinogenic pesticides and other industrial pollutants. Contamination of meat with sex hormones. American meat, when cattle go into the feedlots for 100 days before slaughter, they're injected with high levels of sex hormones to increase cattle weight, the carcass weight. And these sex hormones remain in the meat. And when children eat them, or when any people eat them, they're having meat laden with sex hormones, and this is clear, these which are carcinogenic. Then you have nitrite preservatives in hot dogs. The nitrites will react with amines to form carcinogenic nitrosamines, and the chemistry data on this is clear-cut. Exposure to carcinogenic pesticides in the home and garden and pet flea collars. Exposure to carcinogenic ingredients in baby products and children's toiletries. Believe it or not, we put out a press release 3 months ago, listing the products which are used in for babies and for children's toiletries, and these contain numerous carcinogens in them. Without any regulation, the National Cancer Institute has failed to warn against any of these. American Cancer Society is in bed with the cosmetic industry. And so those are some avoidable causes of childhood cancer for which there is solid, scientific, documented information. If time permits, and if you'd like me to continue, I could move on to breast cancer or entirely as you please.
Well, I tell you what, I have a couple of callers here, and sure. I'd like to involve them in the conversation too. So why don't we do that, and
please
we'll
do talk
with someone in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi. First, I just wanted to say thank you for having the show. I have been waiting for somebody to come on and say this, but I just wanted to take it a step further and see what you had to say about this. I had read a book called Living Downstream, and one of the things she talked about...
Yes, Sandra Steingraber.
Yes, and she had talked about how, you know, one of the things that they say for preventing cancer is losing weight, and I thought it was interesting that she also pointed out that a lot of these carcinogenic pesticides tend to accumulate in fat. So, you know, I just thought it was interesting that, you know, the real culprit, it would suggest to me, is not the fat, it's the pesticides that accumulate in fat. So I just thought that was really interesting.
Very good point. There is no question. There's a big family of carcinogens which are fat-soluble and accumulate in body fat. And just to give you an example for this, if you take breast milk from a woman who's just started lactating and you analyze the concentration of a wide range of carcinogenic contaminants, you find they're very, very high immediately when lactation begins. But when you compare these over the course of the next 2 months or so, you find by the end of 2 months, the levels of contaminants drop down to almost zero because the breast has been cleared of all these carcinogenic pesticides. And I could go into this in more detail, but time doesn't permit me, except to point out that the evidence relating obesity and cancer is, to say the least, thin or tenuous or non-existent, with one exception, that is with breast cancer, where there is a clear relationship. Now, I should tell you that the American Cancer Society has recently came out with statements listing obesity is responsible for about over 30-35% of cancers. And they cited as the evidence for this four references in the scientific literature. When you look at these references in the scientific literature, which they use as the basis of these claims, you see that none of them say anything about that. They just are suggestive. They suggest that a diet on obesity may have a relationship, particularly obesity, but there's no solid scientific evidence with the exception of the postmenopausal breast cancer. So the whole emphasis of the National Cancer Institute and American Cancer Society is what we call blame the victim. If you get cancer, it's your own fault. You've chosen the wrong parents. In other words, it's genetics. Well, this is a load of nonsense because genetics of human populations cannot have changed in the course of a few decades. It takes tens of thousands of years. Well, after genetics, there's smoking. Well, there is no question that smoking is the single most important cause of cancer. But there's also no question that lung cancer rates are moving sharply down, but at the same time, the incidence of a wide range of non-smoking cancers is moving up. And then obesity, which is the other factor too, for which the evidence is virtually non-existent. But you're absolutely right that there are, in the totality of the environment, in our air, our water, our food, the workplace, our cosmetics and toiletries, there are a very wide range of what we call fat-soluble carcinogens, that is, petrochemicals, which dissolve in fat and remain in fat. And if you do a fat biopsy of the average American, you can find up to 100 different carcinogens there. Now, the point about this is, who is paid, who receives funds, who is responsible for providing this information to Congress, providing this information to the public, telling the public what to do to reduce their own risk of cancer, telling Congress what is necessary to do to reduce exposures to these avoidable carcinogens. And I charge the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society with this is the reason why my book is called Cancergate, the analogy to Eradgate. I charge them with responsibility for millions of cancers over the last few decades. And I don't make these charges lightly, and at risk of being repetitive, if you look at the book Cancergate, How to Win the Losing Cancer War, you will find solid documentation for all of these statements. And in addition, and I think I've repeated this once or possibly twice before, these major themes have been endorsed unequivocally by well over 100 leading national and international experts on cancer prevention and public health, quite apart from citizen activist groups. And at risk of using this program for advertisement purposes, which is maybe improper, may I merely mention that those of you who are interested in getting such documentation in the Cancergate book, you can obtain it from Baywood Publishing Company, and the 800 number there is 638-7819, 638-7819.
Okay, well, we have some other callers, and we have about 15 minutes left, and let me again introduce our guest is Samuel Epstein. He is a physician. He's professor emeritus of environmental and occupational medicine at the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And again, if you're interested in reading on the subject, the book is titled Cancergate, How to Win the Losing Cancer War, and it's published by Baywood Publishing. We do have a couple of callers here, and we'll go next to Bloomington, Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hi. You're going to talk about cancer risk in breast cancer, and certainly you've talked about the failure to inform the public of the risks. Allow me to talk about the abortion breast cancer link. A large number of studies have been done on the connection between abortion and breast cancer, and the vast majority of these studies have found substantially higher risk of breast cancer in women who have had abortions. I think the best known, certainly the best publicized study of this increased risk was done in 1994 by the Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. The reason this study was publicized, the Hutchinson Center is very prestigious, and the lead researcher of the study was Dr. Janet Dehling, who was a very pro-choice doctor. And Dr. Dehling was interviewed on nationwide TV after she published her results. Her results found a 50% increase in breast cancer among women under 45 who had undergone any induced abortion. And Dr. Epstein will confirm, I guess, normally women have about a 10% chance of suffering from breast cancer. Well, women who have had abortions have not a 10% risk, but a 15% risk. And when Dr. Dehling was pressured to minimize her findings, she did say, well, women should consult with their doctors. But she said her study was very fair. She said it was a fair analysis. She said it was statistically sound. And she said, I'm very pro-choice, but she said science is science.
Well, let's get Dr. Epstein's comment.
I think your speaker is, the questioner was quite right to point out the body of information associating abortion and breast cancer. I wish I could completely agree with him. I think the evidence is interesting, but there are as many negative studies on this as there are positive. And I might mention that But there is one nation which is has the highest abortion rate in the world, where in fact abortion is practiced as a standard method of birth control, which is Japan. And Japanese breast cancer rates have been exceptionally low. But on the other hand, I'm not willing to dismiss the possibility. I don't believe one can make definitive relationships between these, because for every single study which has incriminated abortion and breast cancer, there have been studies with the opposite findings. So I have an open mind on the matter, but I simply would point out that the evidence from Japan isn't exactly supportive. But I think your caller is very right to draw attention to it, and thank you.
All right, let's go to line number one for someone else. This is Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned the carcinogens that are found in breast milk, and that's something that's come up a lot in breastfeeding communities lately. But I'm concerned that there might be some mothers who would choose to feed their babies formula rather than breast milk. But wouldn't you say that formula would have the risk of having similar carcinogens, since the ones that are in the mother's breast milk come from the same type of environment that the cows are living in? I mean, I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a very good question. The reason for the concerns about mother's milk are that over the course of, say, you're dealing with a woman of 35, during that 35 years, she has accumulated a massive concentrations of some 100 or so carcinogens in her breast fat. So the very first time she breastfeeds, those carcinogens will come out with the milk. Over the next 2 to 3 months or so, her breast will gradually be cleared of these carcinogens, and by 3 months' time, the levels of carcinogens in the breast milk are reduced. Now, formula milk would not represent the first lactation. However, I have an open mind on the matter, because there's two reasons why breastfeeding, quite apart from the cancer risk, is very important. First of all, and very importantly, it establishes a critical bond between mother and infant. Secondly, breast milk is high in a growth factor, and very high, particularly colostrum, and in a month or two afterwards, is very high in a natural growth factor known as insulin-like growth factor 1, which is terribly important for growth and development. So if a child is deprived of the IGF-1 in colostrum, then the chances of that child growing into its full potential are really reduced. So the answer is really a woman is faced with an impossible dilemma. But my own personal viewpoint would be to breastfeed for a short period of time, minimally, to establish the bond. But far more importantly, for mothers all over this country to cry in protest and to scream at the industry and the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute for not having warned them, for over the last decades sat back and allowed the chemical industry to pollute the totality of our environment, our air, our water, our food, and the workplace. That's where women's anger should go. And if you look at a press release of mine on the cancer prevention website called preventcancer.com, you'll find something which is unbelievable, perhaps to you, that is an examination of toiletries, shampoos and lotions, which are put on babies, and there are many carcinogens in them, and the infants are exquisitely sensitive to carcinogens. So what we really need is anger of the citizenry of this country, who, because of the avoidable causes of disease, of cancer and death, by institutions, federal institutions, the National Cancer Institute, and this so-called nonprofit, the American Cancer Society, and I strongly recommend boycotting the American Cancer Society, that have abysmally failed in their abundant and bounden duty to inform the public of avoidable causes of cancer. And I'm not talking about hypothetical, I'm talking about publications in peer-reviewed literature. I don't know if you know, to get an article published in a prestigious journal, that article goes through several stages of review by 1, 2, or 3 reviewers who don't know each other, and on the basis of that, the editor will decide whether to publish it. All my information, which I've attempted to summarize, which you'll find in the CancerGate book, the majority of that has been published in the International Journal of Health Services, the world's leading public health journal in this field. So we're not talking about fancy, we're talking about solid scientific fact. And the real issue that's needed is, one, to boycott the American Cancer Society and give your funding to alternative citizen groups or to scientific groups that are trying to do something to reduce the incidence of cancer and to alert the public to this, and to put pressure on Congress to force the National Cancer Institute to increase its budget for prevention, which is about 3-4%, to increase it to the same level as for diagnosis and treatment. And I strongly recommend that pressure should be put on to ensure that this current 3% level should go up to 50%. There should be at least as much resources spent on prevention as on screening, treatment, and diagnosis, because the more cancer you prevent, the less cancer there is to treat. This simple fact seems to have escaped the attention and understanding of the cancer establishment, the National Cancer Institute, American Cancer Society, and it's up to you. You have far more power in this than I do. I'm simply giving you the information. You, John, the citizen, Jane, and John, have the power in your hands to say, we refuse to give money to the American Cancer Society, and we demand through our congressional representatives that the American National Cancer Institute be brought into account on charges of conflict of interest, failure to follow the instructions of the National Cancer Act to provide information on avoidable causes of cancer, to establish a register of occupation of environmental carcinogens and occupational carcinogens, a register of all the carcinogens in the totality of our environment, so that you and others can take steps to force these changes in policy, which will reduce these exposures.
Thank you. You mentioned the possibility of giving money to alternative groups. Are those groups listed on preventcancer.org?
No, I don't do that because I think it would be invidious. I think you have to make up your own mind on this. Any activist citizen group, or groups that are concerned about issues like air pollution, proximity to hazardous waste sites. There's a multiplicity of these, but the other point you should follow clearly is there's no chance of getting any changes through Congress. Congress is gridlocked, and it's split hopelessly between Democrats and Republicans. So you will not be able to, however strenuous your objections are, however well organized you are, you won't get any change through Congress because they're gridlocked. However, the way to focus your critical skills are through state governors. Governors of every state are acutely sensitive to the interests and needs of citizens in their state. For instance, those of you who may live near a hazardous waste site or through a petrochemical plant that's pumping out carcinogens into the air, organize in your local village or town or community. Write letters to your newspaper, form alliances, sometimes with citizen groups, and then reach the governor. Get your facts, and you'll find most of the facts you want in my book. You'll find them elsewhere, too. And the governor of the state is the critical focal point to go to, because whether they're Democrats or Republicans, their concern is the health, welfare, and well-being of citizens in their state. That is where the key point of action should be. Of course, also, for those of you who, and this is a horrible thing to have to say, because this implies different standards for people who are well-off and people who are not well-off, but the fact remains that organic foods, first of all, they're more expensive by varying degrees, but they are much safer than non-organic foods, which are laced with carcinogenic pesticides. Now, here we have a terrible dilemma in which the middle class and upper middle class can afford this luxury, but lower socioeconomic groups, apart from all their other problems of delayed access to healthcare, minimal education, etc., they cannot afford organic, safe organic foods. So I feel very, very ambivalent when I make these statements, because I realize that what we're really saying, that there's one law for the well-off and another law or another set of practices for those that are not well-off. But let's leave that alone for the moment. Let us say organize locally, get your information, use the information on the website. You'll find masses of information on the Cancer Prevention Coalition website. Arm yourself with the information, and once you've armed yourself, decide how to proceed. Take, for instance, cosmetics and toiletries, or take radiated food. In schools, kids get fed with irradiated meat. They get also soft snacks and fast foods. Say this instead of vegetables. There's a wide range of areas in which you can be active, but organize on the village, on the community, and on the town, and write to your local newspaper, and contact the governor directly or indirectly, and tell him that the life and the death of citizens in his or her state depends on what he's going to do for you. Yeah. And if he doesn't do it, get rid of him.
We're going to have to stop because we've used our time. For people who would like to read more on the subject, you can certainly look for the book that we've talked about. It's titled Cancergate, How to Win the Losing Cancer War, published by Baywood. Also, if you're interested and you have internet access, you can go to the website of the Cancer Prevention Coalition, which is www.preventcancer.com. And there is indeed a lot of information there, as our guest says. Dr. Samuel Epstein is Professor Emeritus of Environmental and Occupational Medicine at the School of Public Health, University of Illinois, Chicago. And Dr. Epstein, thanks very much.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.
Our program today is made possible in part with support from the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, presenting Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat from Wednesday, August 3rd to Sunday, August 14th. After being sold as a slave, Joseph is taken to Egypt, where he interprets Pharaoh's dreams and saves Egypt from famine. Music includes Close Every Door to Me, One More Angel, Any Dream Will Do, and more. Ticket information available at 1-888-261-9675. Programs here on AM 580, also made possible by grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about money. We'll talk about personal finances with budget counselor Shannon Plate. She will join us this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. She's the author of the how-to book, Degunking Your Personal Finances. Let's take a look now at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade. Corn continues lower while beans are higher. September wheat trading at 326.5, down 4. December 340.75, down 3.75. September corn 230.75, down 2.75. December corn 241.5, down 3.25. March 249, down 2.75. May 253.25, down 2.5. August soybeans 670.5, up 1.5.